The Capital Investment Committee hearing for January 9th is called to order. Members, we don't have a quorum, and so we will move along with our agenda, and then we'll take up the minutes right when we have quorum. Today, members, I do want to note that we do have the 2023-24 Capital Investment Rules and Procedures that were emailed to you. That was also included in your folders. If you have any questions, feel free to let me know. With Representative Grasso here, we do have a quorum. And so, Representative Ryer, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 4th?
I move approval of the minutes for January 4th.
Representative Ryer moves approval of the minutes for January 4th. Members, I do want to note small corrections. On the first meeting, there's two ayes. And so I will direct the staff to make that edit as we move forward. Members, any discussion of the minutes? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for January 4th are approved. Members, the $1.2 trillion Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was signed into law on November 15, 2021. And at that time, we were busy traveling throughout the state of Minnesota looking at local projects across the entire state. And so during the 2022 session, we held three House Capital Investment Committee hearings on IIJA to understand its impact on our work as we move forward. Today, we have the Minnesota Management and Budget Office here to provide an update of the status of IIJA allocations and awards to Minnesota and the required state matches. On Wednesday of this week, NCSL Expert will provide more federal updates on IIJA. Now we'll start with MMB, Ms. Liz Conner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Liz Conner. I am the Strategic Initiatives Manager at Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with the committee today. I will be giving a high-level overview of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, or IIJA, as it's commonly known as. I know that there are some agency staff who, if there are specific questions about programs, are probably better suited to speak to some of those details, but I'm happy to give a high-level view of what the state has been working on over the past year or so. So, as the chair mentioned, the IIJA provides $1.2 trillion over 5 years from federal fiscal year 2022 through 26. It's essentially two different omnibus bills packaged into one. Roughly $650 million of the IIJA includes the reauthorization of the Federal Surface Transportation Program, and this is represented by the large blue share of the pie chart on the slide that you see in front of you. And the remaining nearly $550 million funds general infrastructure investments that focus on roads and bridges, transit, water, energy, climate resiliency and adaptation, and broadband. In terms of what it means for Minnesota, according to Federal Funds Information for States, or FFIS, allocation estimates for Minnesota for formula-driven awards total over $7.4 billion. And most of this funding, about $6.1 billion, needs to be matched by non-federal sources. All federal awards with a known state share were accounted for in the governor's supplemental and or capital budgets last session. And similarly, we expect that his biennial budget for fiscal year 24-25 will include proposals for matching funds, as well as spending authority for the federal programs that are authorized in the IIJA. Shifting to the next slide, the chart you see here is based on those numbers that I mentioned from FFIS, detailing the formula allocations that Minnesota is expected to receive. In total, we expect that Minnesota will receive an additional $2.2 billion in new formula funding through IIJA compared to baseline levels. The vast majority of those funding increases, as you can see, will happen at MnDOT, the Met Council, and Public Facilities Authority. And the chart you see here really does further illustrate the IIJA's focus on transportation. I won't go into detail on all of the programs, but clearly MnDOT will be playing a central role, and they already have been in implementation of the IIJA as they receive funding for roads, bridges, rail, airports, and electric vehicle infrastructure. Funding for transit, over $1 billion to the Metropolitan Council, and water infrastructure, nearly $700 million going to Public Facilities Authority, are also key components of the legislation. Among other highlights, the bill directs $76 million for the weatherization assistance program at the Department of Commerce, over $100 million for broadband development, and nearly $18 million for state and local cybersecurity enhancements. Now, what you probably notice is not part of the IIJA is a flexible source of funding, such as the relief funds that were included in the CARES Act or the American Rescue Plan. The IIJA really just authorizes spending on specific federal grant programs, both formula and competitive, that will flow from federal agencies to state governments and other entities. This next chart is really illustrative in nature. It represents a change item view of the governor's recommendations from last year's 2022 legislative session that included matching funds for IIJA programs. They were not passed into law. It's simply intended to provide a sense of magnitude around matching funds. And it's important to note that some of these budget items, such as those at Public Facilities Authority and the Pollution Control Agency, were intended to provide matching funds for IIJA programs, but also spending increases for agency programs and grants. Across the 2022 capital and supplemental budgets, the governor recommended roughly $392 million in 2022-23, and then another $400 million for fiscal 24 and 25 in new state investments to leverage resources, federal resources in the IIJA. And as I mentioned, the governor's fiscal year 24-25 biennial budget will provide updated proposals related to the IIJA that will support matching funds, adding programmatic capacity and technical assistance for the state agencies to provide to our partners across the state. And additionally, agencies will use the governor's biennial budget proposal, specifically the federal fund summary, as a vehicle to obtain federal fund spending authority for programs in the IIJA that are coming online in fiscal year 24 and 25, as well as in some cases using session law budget increases. This next slide is meant to give a flavor of the coordination happening behind the scenes and that's been going on for the past year or so around the IIJA implementation. MMB and the governor's office and state agencies are in close coordination around the IIJA. Staff at agencies are doing very important intra and inter-agency coordination to ensure that we are maximizing our opportunities from the IIJA. And the governor's office is holding monthly check-ins with stakeholders outside of state government, such as cities, counties, tribes, nonprofits, educational institutions, and other community partners, to make sure that we are working together and doing as much as we can to maximize the impact of the IIJA for Minnesota. One other important resource to note is that there is an enterprise IIJA website hosted at MMB. It's a tool that links to agency-specific sites with more detailed information about the programs that they are implementing and pursuing. There's links to technical assistance and resources for entities that are pursuing opportunities in the IIJA. And we also have a grant opportunity tracking form for entities outside of state government that may be interested in applying for IIJA programming so that, to the extent possible, we can work together to make the most of those opportunities. So to recap, the IIJA is a pretty robust piece of federal legislation. There's 380 programs, both new and existing, in that bill. They include both formula and competitive awards. Minnesota expects to receive $7.4 to $7.5 billion in formula funds over the next 5 years, and $2.2 billion of that amount is new funding for agencies. So far, Minnesota has been awarded nearly $5.9 billion to date. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the authority to spend. Agencies don't necessarily have the authority to spend that money. We may still need matching funds to unlock it, but it's a sign that agencies have been working really hard to unlock those grant opportunities. A majority of the funds will require a state match, and a significant portion of the IIJA was a reauthorization of existing funding as well as increases to funding for programs that are already on the books. And to the point about the awards and allocations, there is a chart that I believe is in your handout. I think it's also been posted online with a list of grant programs where FFIS has detailed the allocation estimates for the state. The next column over shows the award amounts received so far. And I would just note that the allocation estimates are based on FFIS data as of December 28th, 2022. Those numbers often move slightly, but the level of magnitude is basically the $7.4, $7.5 billion. The award amounts are what was provided to MMB by state agencies as of January 5th, 2023. And in some instances, that might reflect an increment of the total award expected to be received. It might be dispersed over the course of several years. The last caveat I would offer is that the document just reflects the awards being made to state agencies. It does not reflect the awards received by cities or counties or tribes or school districts, simply because we don't have visibility into all of the awards that are coming to entities outside of state government. Although we're doing our best to stay in the loop as those awards are given out.
Ms. Conner, for those that are listed as competitive, does this mean that the agencies have applied for them, or are they just out there that's available for the agencies to do so?
Mr. Chair, in some cases agencies have applied, but in other cases, if the application period hasn't opened yet, there wouldn't be an application in progress. We simply know that it would be opening in the future.
And so would this be the final list of what is available for competitive grants, or is there are there other competitive grants out there that we could discuss with the agencies about possibly applying for?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I might defer to agencies if there are things still coming down through the pipeline that aren't listed here. At this point, this is the product of the coordination meetings that we've been having regularly, and so we think we have a pretty good handle on what state agencies will be pursuing, but it's possible there might be some that we haven't captured on this list. And I would leave it to agency staff to speak to any omissions.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers, trying to get all these figures organized here. First of all, is it true that we have $5.9 billion allocated but not spent yet?
Ms. Conner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, the $5.9 billion represents the total coming from award letters that state agencies have received. So if they don't have federal spending authority for that money, or if it requires matching funds, it's essentially parked and not able to be spent. It's just it provides some certainty that once there are matching funds in place and some spending authority provided by the legislature, that the resources would be available.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again to the testifier. So most of that money is parked right now. Could you give a little more clarity as to the matching funds? I see there is one, $2.2 billion in new formula funds, 84% of that requires a match. What is the match amount?
Ms. Conner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, the match amount is, we know that we will need at least probably $400 million in the next two biennia, but the match question is really only part of the resources that agencies are going to need to effectively implement the IIJA. And that $400 million is sort of the ballpark based on what was proposed last session. I think it's safe to say that what will be included in the governor's bill will be larger than what was put forward last session, because we have more information and about different IIJA programs. The other thing I would say is that matching funds are really just one piece of the resources that will be required. Agencies in some cases will need to add additional programmatic capacity to effectively implement a program. Some agencies are looking at adding technical assistance to be a resource to our partners outside of state government, like cities and counties and school districts, as they pursue opportunities of their own and opportunities that might align between state government and outside entities.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so what, is there a match percentage? I mean, we have in statute that, 50%, we require match in a lot of instances. Is there a percentage of this too?
Ms. Connor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, there isn't a flat percentage, and that makes it tricky to give a solid amount. So some programs require a 20% match. Some programs require a 5 or 10 or 15% match. Others require 50% match. And in some cases, there are waivers available for match. So that makes it really difficult to know exactly what the match requirements will be. We do expect that the governor's budget, once that comes out later this month, will provide a lot more information around the specific match number.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's important for us to know a couple of things. One is how much money is available in this and what the match is for each. When I say how much money is available, how much money we need to appropriate to match what is allocated. So it's very important that we know that and the various percentages of the matches.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. I think if I understand Ms. Connor, once we have the governor's budget, they will have that information for us, and that should be coming to us by the end of the month. Next up, we have Representative Hansen, and then Representative Kozlowski, and then Representative Carroll. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Connor. I'm looking at the IIJ allocations, the back page with the water category, and that includes the revolving fund, clean water revolving fund, the drinking water fund, wastewater, emerging contaminants. So, and it says formula. So when that money comes into the state, I think the IIJA has a number of criteria that could be applied relating to poverty to make sure that we are making sure the folks who cannot pay for something or have less ability to pay receive the benefits, as is my understanding is the focus from the federal money that we're supposed to have those criteria. So could you highlight maybe what the state is doing, if it's the PFA or others, on trying to make sure that those criteria are applied rather than what was the status quo?
Ms. Connor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. So great question. And I would start by saying I think that Mr. Freeman of the PFA is probably best positioned to speak to that question. I guess what I would say at a high level around the IIJA in general is that there is a focus on equity and social justice and economic justice around all of these programs, and that's something that agencies have been very mindful of in their work implementing the programs. But specifically as far as what PFA is doing, unfortunately, I don't know that I would be able to speak with any certainty around how their approach is working and would defer to Mr. Freeman.
Chair Hansen, we are planning to have the PFA come in and present to our committee before the end of the month. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair and testifiers. My question is maybe a bounce off of what's been echoed here already, but one, would you be able to walk us through the criteria for state matches, when they're required and when they're not, in that 16%, as well as curious if in terms of the dollars that are awarded out to community partners and contractors and whatnot, if there will be requirements for minority or BIPOC-owned women, veterans-owned businesses as well.
Ms. Connor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozlowski, I think, again, I might give an answer similar to what I had to tell Representative Hansen, which is that I think agencies are probably best positioned to speak to the specific match requirements. I don't have all of the information in front of me. I think a lot of programs, I would say, have the typical federal 20% share from non-federal resources. That isn't always the case. And so hopefully agency staff can better speak to those details. And then as far as some of the requirements that you mentioned, I think That certainly has been a focus overall with the IIJA and the authors of the bill at the federal level. And so agency staff, I know, have been having discussions internally about making sure that they adhere to those requirements. So to the extent that you've got questions about those programs, I'd suggest that agencies are maybe better positioned to speak to the specifics.
Representative Kozlowski, we will have the National Council of State Legislators come in and present on Wednesday too, and they may be able to provide some information on that too if you bring it on Wednesday. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. My colleague from Duluth beat me to the punch, so my question has been asked and answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed. Ms. Connor, are you done with yours? Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Ms. Connor. So now we'll turn it over to Ms. Conboy, who will be presenting on the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, specifically the Coronavirus Capital Projects Fund. And then with her, we do have two other testifiers. One is from, let's see here, Deed from the offense for the broadband and multi-purpose community facility project. And then we also have Mr. Adosh Uni from MDE to talk about the grant application that the state has submitted to the Department of Treasury at the U.S. level. So please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Marianne Conboy, and I'm the Capital Budget Coordinator at Minnesota Management and Budget. My colleagues at the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Department of Education and I will be providing background about the Capital Projects Fund. The Coronavirus Capital Projects Fund was established in the Federal American Rescue Plan Act of 2021 to provide payments to states, territories, freely associated states, and tribal governments, quote, to carry out critical capital projects directly enabling work, education, and health monitoring, including remote options, in response to the public health emergency with respect to the coronavirus disease COVID-19, end quote, according to its statutory language. The U.S. Department of the Treasury released guidance in September 2021, which included information about the process to receive funds and the project eligibility. The Capital Projects Fund is not a competitive grant program. Each state has its own allocation. Minnesota's allocation is $180.7 million. Funds must be expended by December 31st, 2026. For a capital project to be an eligible use of the Capital Projects Fund, it must meet all of the following criteria. First, capital projects must invest in capital assets designed to directly enable work, education, and health monitoring, emphasizing the and. What does this mean? According to Treasury guidance, a project can be a new construction, a purchase or installation of a capital asset, or improvements and repairs to a capital asset. And recipients must show that projects are designed to jointly and directly enable work, education, and health monitoring. However, these activities need not be the exclusive function or purpose of the project. The second criteria is that the capital project is designed to address a critical need that resulted from or was made apparent or exacerbated by the COVID-19 public health emergency. Treasury guidance points to access to high quality, affordable, and reliable internet for access to services as an example. The third criteria is that the capital project is designed to address a critical need of the community to be served by it. Communities with a critical need for the project include those that do not have access to the resources or services that are provided by the project, whether because of the physical absence or because of access to those resources is unaffordable. This slide provides some background for the guidance that was provided to the states by Treasury at the time when states were deciding on how to use the funds. According to the Treasury guidance, broadband infrastructure projects that construct and deploy broadband infrastructure, digital connectivity technology projects for devices and equipment to facilitate broadband internet access, and multi-purpose community facility projects to construct or improve buildings that are designed to jointly enable work, education, and health monitoring are all presumptively eligible for the fund. Notably, general infrastructure projects like highways and bridges are ineligible for the fund. There was also an option for a case-by-case review. The final plans for how each state would use its allocation were required to be submitted to Treasury by September 2022. Minnesota met that deadline and has submitted its final plans for its $180.7 million allocation. In Minnesota's plan, two of the three presumptively eligible programs on the previous slide were selected. Broadband infrastructure projects made up 72% of the total allocation with $130.7 million. Those amounts were appropriated by the legislature in the 2021 first special session and in the 2022 legislative session. Details about the specific broadband programs and how these funds will be used will be provided in a moment by Deed. Multipurpose community facility projects made up 28% of the total allocation with $50 million. This amount was submitted to Treasury after the 2022 legislative session ended with a $50 million unappropriated. This part of the plan utilized Legislative Advisory Commission, or LAC, authority, which is the process for legislative review before executive branch agencies expend federal money. Details about the multipurpose community facility projects program that was submitted to Treasury will be provided in a moment by MDE. And Treasury provided three examples of what a multipurpose community facility might look like. One example would be projects to construct or improve libraries that provide public access to the internet for purposes including work, education, and health monitoring, such as offering digital skills programs and support for community members engaging in virtual learning. There's other examples too, but we will get to that when you get to MDE's part of the presentation. And finally, this is just another view of seeing how the state's $180.7 million allocation is set to be spent. Again, each program was submitted to Treasury already, and Treasury assesses, approves, and releases funds for each program plan separately. So these broadband plans up at the top have all received Treasury approval to be spent, but Minnesota awaits Treasury approval or feedback for the multipurpose community facility projects program. And if there aren't any questions, I can turn it over to Bree Mackey, the broadband director.
We have a question from Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are getting quite a few requests about, you know, community centers and things like that. And you mentioned, you know, having a library in as one example. Well, I certainly like that more books are in community centers, but could you give some other potential uses? I mean, what about gymnasiums and those types of facilities?
Ms. Conboy.
Mr. Chair and members, there were two other examples that Treasury provided that helped like illustrate this, which I can provide. One example was projects to construct or improve community health centers. And with that example, in addition to engaging in health monitoring, would provide a broader range of services to the communities they serve, including activities such as access to job counseling, employment services, as well as health education classes or internship programs for medical professionals. Also, full-service community schools was like another example where you would have an educational component, health monitoring for students and members of the community, and workforce training and career counseling all under the same roof. So I think there's lots of details and ideas that could come up because it's such a broad, seemingly broad program in how you can interpret it. But the key is to have the three components of work, education, and health monitoring in the same place.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I think it opens up some potential for some ideas around the state.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Conboy, I have a question about how typical our experience is related to that last category, the multipurpose community facility projects. Is this what other states are seeing, or is there some unexpected bumps in terms of turning this around? I just ask because the other pieces seem to move pretty readily, and I'm just wondering what level of concern is warranted, or this is just predictable.
Ms. Conboy.
Mr. Chair and members, I think when this program first was moving along, I think it took a while to get the initial application back for the border-to-border broadband back. So that feedback took a number of months. And so this would, the multipurpose community facility projects program that was submitted is new from the state to Treasury. So I think it's normal to expect a number of months for Treasury to review. But I don't know if MDE has additional details to share.
Mr. Ooney, why don't you cover this once we get to your presentation? Representative Ryer. Representative Grassel.
I'll pass.
All right, seeing no other questions, please proceed. Ms. Mackey, Director Mackey, please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name for the record is Bree Mackey, and I'm the Director of the Office of Broadband Development. I'm going to go over three of the programs that are part of the Capital Projects Fund. The first being the Border-to-Border Broadband Grant Program, which has the $85.7 million in funding. Many of you already know this program as it is Minnesota's grant program designed to catalyze and draw other investments into areas that most need and otherwise do not get service by private investment alone. This is, again, our existing program, and it really helps to bridge the gaps with the business cases for new and existing providers to invest in building broadband infrastructure into underserved or unserved areas of the state. I will also just note that we are just finishing our seventh round of awards that came out in December and also had launched our eighth program award RFP, which is currently going on. The second program that we offer through the Office of Broadband is the Broadband Line Extension Program, which has $15 million. This is a new program that addresses the needs for homes and businesses that may already not have broadband service available close enough that it's close enough to the road but are unable to afford the actual access to construct the charge to the to their actual home. And I just want to give one example of this. In May of 2020, the Office of Broadband received an inquiry from a resident where two adults were working from home and two students, children, were trying to do distance learning. There was broadband at the end of their driveway, but the quote to be able to get the service to their door was $2,000, and it was just not attainable for this family. The final program I'd like to share in this presentation is the Broadband Lower Population Density Pilot Program, which is $30 million. This is a new program that will go through our border-to-border program. It is there to address the feedback from providers and communities that the program's current cap in border-to-border of 50% is an eligible cost, and up to $5 million per project is just not adequate to meet and support the needs of those harder served areas in our state. The pilot program enables awards up to 75% of eligible project costs with a cap of $10 million per project. These projects will receive additional points in the regular border-to-border application programs for some narratives that our applicants have to provide, and also a ranking criteria based on how many are served per mile. So per pass per mile within the ranking criteria is how we will look at it as we're scoring this new program. And with that, those are my background, unless there's questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director. Seeing no question, why don't we move on to Director Ooney. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Adosh Ooney. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Minnesota Department of Education. And I'll just provide a little background on our Community Projects Fund application for the multipurpose community facility projects. And Ms. Conboy provided some details, so there may be a little bit of repetition, so my apologies there, but I'll try to get through this as quickly as possible. So in partnership with the Governor's Children's Cabinet, MDE submitted the application proposal to the U.S. Treasury for $50 million focused on multipurpose community facility projects. And as mentioned, while we haven't received any feedback yet, based on the normal course of normal course with applications like this, such as with the feds, we anticipate some substantial back and forth with the Treasury when we do start hearing back to answer questions, provide clarity, and refine our proposal. And I just heard back, Representative, to your question, we haven't heard any feedback from other states on this, but I think to Ms. Conboy's point, this is a new program, so I think everybody's just kind of sorting it out right now. The multi-purpose community facility project is one option for CFP funding, and in selecting this option, the projects, as Ms. Conboy mentioned, must support and promote education, work, and health services in those locations. I'm happy to provide some examples from our application just to give people a flavor later on. We submitted an application back in September 2022, and we expect it could take, you know, we expect to hear back, hopefully approval sometime later this year, maybe in the fall, and then it could take up to approximately 1 year for approval. But we haven't received any information about a specific timeline. The funds have to be used for capital projects, and the completion date for these funds for those projects is December 31st, 2026. We're unfortunately unable to provide firm details on what the RFP will look at this time, but we can kind of provide some parameters around what it will look like. I just want to be clear not to mislead anybody about this is what it's going to be. This is just what we're thinking it's going to be based on our experience and our applications. So MD is going to create a framework for grant administration scoring system for the grantees. We will anticipate that the application process, scoring, application selection, administration of the grants to organizations in greater Minnesota will be run by the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, or MIFs. The same process for the 7-county metro area may occur at the greater Twin Cities United Way, given their leadership and key connections in the metro area. We have worked with these entities before to distribute federal funds during the pandemic, so we have some experience working with them, and they have experience, much experience in this and others working with entities in their local communities. So in terms of a program description, through a competitive process, we're going to fund project, or the state will fund projects that meet fund requirements and support community revitalization, connectedness, and equity by promoting education and work and health for Minnesota children and families in priority communities. The state will invest in areas that benefit the most to address challenges exacerbated by the pandemic, support cross-sector strategies to advance economic stability, educational opportunity, and well-being, and leverage and align existing investments and strategies. As Ms. Conboy mentioned, the guidance from Treasury says that acknowledges multiple types of these multi-purpose community facilities, including full-service community schools, community health centers, and libraries. And having options for different models of community service delivery allows communities to identify the best model to address the needs specific to their community. And that's why the requirement of education, work, and health services would apply to the entities. Multiple types of entities, because we're trying to work with the entities that exist in each individual community. Specifically in Minnesota, we're looking at dedicating them to family resource centers, which include full service, community schools, libraries, community centers, and other entities like community-based organizations and community colleges, again, who are well-positioned to leverage capital funds for family resource center goals and missions. Mm-hmm. And I'll just detail some priority points for what the eligibility will be based on. So we're looking at service to historically and persistently disinvested communities, commitment to collaborative leadership and community partnerships, demonstrated need or demand for multi-purpose community facility, mission, vision, and action, and access, and feasibility and cost justification. So again, we hope to hear from Treasury soon, anticipate some back and forth, and our application has a proposed project start date of March 1st, 2024, and we hope to have a approval in the fall of 2023.
So, Mr. Uni, in reviewing the guidance that came out from Treasury, I believe about a year or two ago, one of the eligible expenses is for reimbursement, and so I'm just curious to see, is that part of the application that NDE have put towards Treasury, understanding that a lot of our communities had to go through this process and use their own, you know, funds to address the pandemic, you know, with some of the projects that may qualify under this program?
So, Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to have to phone a friend for that specific question about reimbursement. I'm getting that information right now, so I'm wondering if there's any other question. I'd be happy to answer that, but I'm going to get you an answer directly to that shortly.
Members, any questions for Mr. Uni? Representative Wright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's really about the timeline for those programs. If the funds have to be expended by the end of December 2026, and if we're up and running, say, in March of 2024, what does it mean for those funds to have to be expended? Because there could be a fair amount of work that has to happen between somebody having the grant and getting the construction and the work completed. So do you have concerns about that timeline? How does that work?
Mr. Rooney.
Representative members, based on our experience around libraries with library construction grants that generally are funded through the bonding bill, as well as funding that we've seen for full service community schools and building up those specific entrances and specific facilities for that, we've seen that turnaround time of around two and a half years for completing those projects. We're confident that those projects can get completed, especially with the expertise and relationships of the grant administration process that we're hopeful to set up. And then after the completion of setting up those facilities, those projects, the use for the programming would be over the next 5 years. And so one thing I'd left off is that after the 2026 completion of those capital and facility improvement projects, the uses for work, education, and health services would have to continue for the ensuing 5 years. So until I think, let's say the project's completed by December of 2026, they would have to continue offering those services to their community until December of 2031.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I'm clear, the actual construction funds being expended equals all of the construction and work being done. Is that correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Representative Ryer, yes. So we would want the projects completed and the money spent by that time. Yep.
I'll see no further questions. Thank you all for coming by to present on this. Next on the agenda, the last item will be the 2023 bond cancellation report from MMB Assistant Commissioner Jan Hassemer. Welcome to the committee, Assistant Commissioner Hassemer. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon to members of the committee for the record. My name is Jennifer Hassemer. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management at Minnesota Management and Budget. So I will just take a couple minutes today and give you an overview of the cancellation report process. This is a statute that applies to all capital projects funded in a bonding bill. Minnesota Statute Section 16A.642 gives capital projects funded in a bonding bill approximately 4 years to commit their funds and start moving their project forward. This four-year timeline does not mean that all of the funds need to be spent within the 4 years, but just that the funds need to be obligated in the state's accounting system. So what that means for state agency projects is typically a design contract or a construction contract that is executed. And for local projects, it means the local community needs to have entered into a grant agreement with the responsible state agency. This cancellation statute applies to all funding sources in a bonding bill. So that includes general obligation bonds, general fund cash for capital projects, and any projects or programs funded by state appropriation bonds. MMB is required to report to the legislature at the beginning of January each year about the projects and appropriations slated for cancellation in the current year. And just last week, MMB published its 2023 cancellation report, which I believe was included in your meeting packet for today. That the 2023 report reported on appropriations from the 2018 bonding bill and earlier that are slated for cancellation this year. The sum total in that report is just over $25 million. About $1 million of those dollars are for general fund funded capital projects, and the remaining $24 million is for bonding appropriations. Those balances will cancel on July 1st this year unless they are reauthorized and re-extended by the current legislature in the current session. MMB has placed hold on those appropriations in the state accounting system, so no further activity can occur without a legislative extension. On July 1st, those funds will cancel if they have not been reauthorized, and any canceled balances will be used to pay down existing state debt, or in cases where we can determine that we have not yet sold the bonds for those projects, then we will reduce future planned bond sales. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions on the cancellation report or turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Hasmer. So they have 4 years, generally, in which to spend this money. What if they wish, they decide they don't want it? I mean, can they turn it back in earlier?
Commissioner Hasmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, there's a couple paths. They could just let the funds expire because the statute would then just naturally pick them up after 4 years. If they've determined before the four-year time period has expired that they no longer want those funds, they can always engage in a discussion with this committee and with the legislature about canceling those funds early.
Okay, thank you.
Erdahl.
Thank you.
Commissioner, looking at the general fund piece, I'm just curious, we have some dating back to 2014. And so why are these still in the book? Have they been extended in the past? That's why they're still there?
Mr. Chair, there's probably different stories. I don't have the exact spreadsheet in front of me right now. Like I said before, they do not need to be fully spent within the four-year time period. They can just be working their way towards through construction. So now that they're showing up on the report, it could be that they've completed their construction and there was a small remaining balance that they no longer needed, which we're now picking up in the report.
Thank you. Members, any additional questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like there's some big ticket items in here that not a penny was spent on. And did we have any indication that those were not viable some time ago? Is it COVID or is it just the project was not ready for prime time when it was appropriated?
Commissioner Hasmer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, there's probably a mixture of stories behind some of those projects. There are a couple where we know the project no longer is seeking the state funding, so they are turning it back to the state. Anecdotally, we heard of some that had been slowed down by the pandemic in assembling their full funding package, and perhaps were before the legislature last session as well, hoping for an extension in the 2022 session, but those did not come, so it's possible that there are some projects that will still come back and seek extensions from the legislature this year.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the flood hazard mitigation grants and the reinvest in Minnesota, are the agencies seeking for those to be not canceled and put into the grant program, or are they looking for those to cancel? Have you heard from DNR or Bowser?
I don't think we have DNR or Bowser here. So, Commissioner, if you have any response to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we'll have to look into that. I don't have the exact answer for you right now.
Members, any additional questions for the Assistant Commissioner? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, kind of down that same sort of line. On 2021, like housing, there's like $40 million that didn't get spent. It just seems like housing is something that we as a committee have talked a lot about needing, and just wondering.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lilly, I believe you're looking at the page with the state appropriation bond list on there, and that represents the housing infrastructure bonds, and the remaining balance, if I recall correctly, is all in the 2021 authorization line, which all came online and became available to MHFA in 2022. I don't think MHFA is here to speak to how they've programmed those funds, but I believe there is still a plan to use those.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Ms. Conboy, for being here with us today. Members, thank you all for your participation. Our next meeting is on Wednesday, January 11th. As mentioned, NCSL staff will be here to testify and present to us remotely on IIJA's six core infrastructure areas and to provide us any new guidance from the federal government. This meeting is adjourned.